Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome to Going In Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell. I think finally not stuffy and all raspy, so hopefully I'm not annoying to listen to this week, but this episode's going to be a fun one. It's going to be a little bit different than any of the others that we've had so far. We've got a graphic novel creator on this week, T.Y. Lee, and really, it's interesting because it's not your typical comic book. It's actually delving into the history behind some of the LA riots, and then specifically the Rooftop Koreans, which some of you may have heard of. I know I'd heard a little bit about it, but in digging more into it and preparing for this conversation, I'm so excited for it. It's fascinating, and really, I think the fact that it's touching on real history as opposed to an entirely imaginary universe is fascinating. But before we get into that, just a couple quick announcements. You guys have heard me talk about it. I'm a speaker. I have a book on the way. If you are unfamiliar with my story and what I might speak about or what this book might be about, head over to my website at zachtidwell.com and you can read a little bit about me there. You can also join my mailing list to get announcements about the book for pre-ordering once I do have a release date for it. I think it'll probably still be about a year until it's out. I just started the fourth draft and I'm working with my editor to bring it to print. So there will be more to come on that. Finally, the best way to help grow this show outside of word of mouth is to leave a rating and review wherever you're listening. And outside of that, we also, this episode, along with the last several, are now available as video episodes. So you can go check out my ugly mug interviewing people every week on YouTube, and just search for Going In Blind with Zach Tidwell to find that. And with all that out of the way, please welcome T.Y. Lee. How's it going, man? Thanks for taking the time and coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, Zach. I've been looking forward to this, and I really admire how your show highlights so many different voices and stories from around the country. So I'm really excited to be a part of that, and I'm excited to share more about the Rooftop Koreans and the 1992 Los Angeles riots.
Yeah, I guess that's been one of the cool things about the show is that it's open doors to be able to speak with so many people that I never would have business being in the same room or just never would have crossed paths with. And I think you're a perfect example of that. Like this is, I told you offline, I was never a comic book person, especially now that I can't see it. Probably pretty easy to imagine why I wouldn't be a comic book person, but it's so interesting to me because you have familial ties, at least on some level, to the Rooftop Koreans, or at least the LA area kind of around that time. What can you maybe shed some light on that and then start painting a picture of what was going on back in 92 or even 91 leading into the LA riots and what the story behind all of this is?
Yeah, I can do that. So, a bit more about me is, I am a Korean American who was born in the U.S. to Korean immigrant parents. My parents, were born in Korea and they later immigrated to, the Fairfax, Virginia area, which is where they met. And later, they got married and I was born. So growing up in a Korean American family, I've always been like deeply fascinated by the story of the rooftop Koreans as well as the LA riots. And when the LA riots were happening back in 1992, I was really, really young. So I wasn't like super familiar with the events. Like I didn't really know a lot of what was going on back then because I was so young and so little. And I do have like some relatives who live in LA. So a lot of my dad's family members, like some of his siblings live in LA. And, you know, my father and my mother both come from very, very large families. So my dad is like one of 10 children and my mother is one of 8. And yeah, so yeah, I have a very large family and lots of cousins, and they pretty much all have like at least 4 kids. The only one who doesn't have any kids is me. And and the thing is, like I said, I have a lot of relatives in LA, and many of them were around during the LA riots. So I was able to learn from them firsthand about like what went on. And the thing is, like, their story doesn't like 100% align with like the prevailing narrative that comes from the mainstream media. So it was a really nice to like learn about the LA riots firsthand from my relatives and really learn about the story of the rooftop Koreans, which I'm sure many of you who are listening are familiar with. I'm sure you've heard of the rooftop Koreans or mentions about them, or you've seen the memes out there on the internet. So I'm definitely, you know, excited to dive more into that.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of curious. So are you an only child with your parents? Obviously, I know you said your extended family is big, but your direct family, is it small or did it end up being big too?
It's pretty small. So I just have one younger brother. So it's just me and him. And, you know, my mother and my father growing up. So our family was relatively small compared to that of my aunts and uncles who all had like at least 4 plus kids.
Yeah. How old are you now?
So I'm actually in my mid-30s, but I actually look a lot younger. What I mean is that most people would think that I'm in my like mid-20s, and some people at, you know, my job actually thought that I was an intern because of how young I look. So, you know, I definitely look a lot younger than I am, but I'm actually in my mid-30s.
I agree, man. No, I was just curious because you said you were really young when the riots were going on, and I'm 29, so I figured once you said that, we were probably around the same age, but I was curious. So when... do you know exactly when your parents came here to the States?
So both my parents actually came here in the 80s. So it was around the mid-80s. I believe my mother came here in 85, I believe. And I think my dad came also in like 84. However, prior to that, I had... you know, lots of other relatives who lived in the States who've immigrated here since like the 60s or 70s. But my parents came here during the mid-80s, but they did not actually meet each other until the late 80s.
Okay. And then along came T.Y. Lee.
Yeah.
Cool. So I guess before maybe we start digging into how you started learning about this, can you, because even, you know, again, I kind of told you offline in prepping for this, I had heard of the rooftop Koreans, but I didn't know, I had heard, I guess, you know, some of what happened there. I didn't understand how much underlying tension there was preceding all of that, specifically between the other different, I guess, minority cultures in that area, in LA. I associated the LA riots with Rodney King. I also didn't realize that it wasn't like an immediate thing. I thought it was Rodney King and then immediate riots. I didn't realize there was all of this racial tension between African Americans, Korean Americans, and Mexican Americans going on in that area, and that it was kind of this pressure cooker. So maybe, especially because you said that the narrative that you got from your family was different than the prevailing narrative. Can you maybe outline the prevailing narrative that has been painted and then start digging into your family's side of things and maybe, I guess, giving us more of a complete picture of it all?
Yeah, I could do that. So obviously many mainstream media sources, they will like...
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Falsely portray the rooftop Koreans as being like evil or racist, or how they like hunted down and killed black people, which is a completely false narrative. The rooftop Koreans did not kill any black people. That is a fact. In fact, they did not actually kill anyone. However, there was one person who unfortunately was killed by friendly fire, and he was a fellow rooftop Korean. But the narrative that rooftop Koreans were hunting down and killing people is completely incorrect and untrue. What really happened is that, you know, many Korean American small business owners, they simply took a stand on the rooftop, protected their stores, you know, fired some warning shots as well as fired some blanks in order to deter looters from coming to their stores. And this was not motivated by any like form of racism. And so, you know, as you were mentioning earlier about how you learned about how there was like a lot of tensions between different races, like tensions between the black community, the Korean American community, and the Hispanic community. There were definitely like a lot of tensions going on that, you know, pretty much began since the 80s. And I would say like during the 80s, a lot of Korean Americans started coming to this country. Like the vast majority of Korean American immigrants actually came here during the 80s. And I think like maybe because of that, that like created some tensions. Like many Korean Americans, you know, who immigrated to this country, who came to LA, were kind of viewed as like outsiders or invaders, and a lot of people did not like that. And another thing is that many Korean American immigrants, and I'm talking first generation immigrants, because they're immigrants and they had like a difficult time looking for jobs and finding jobs in general, they kind of like had no choice but to open their own businesses, because obviously no one would give them jobs. So this is the reason why so many Korean Americans own small businesses, like convenience stores, liquor stores, laundromats, dry cleaners, and many of these small businesses were actually located in like either black or Latino neighborhoods. And I guess many black Americans, as well as many Latino Americans, they saw this as like a group that was like invading their territory. And also like many wealthier Korean Americans began buying lots of real estate in black and Latino neighborhoods. And many would like describe them as like slumlords, because they raised up the rent. So there was like definitely a lot of animosity towards the Korean American community. And one, well, there's like one really notable event that occurred in 1991, and that was, the death of Latasha Harling. So Latasha Harling, she was a 15-year-old Black girl who visited a Korean-American convenience store, and she ended up stealing a bottle of orange juice. And the owner of the store, who was a woman by the name of Do Sunja, she tried to stop her, but Latasha Harling ended up attacking her and beating her. And, you know, eventually Do Sunja, she had no choice but to shoot and kill Latasha Harling in self-defense. And after this incident, she was unfortunately vilified as like a racist, and she became like a victim of a harassment campaign. And, you know, as we were talking earlier about how sometimes the media narrative is different from the actual narrative, in the media narrative, you know, Do Sunja is portrayed as a racist who falsely accused a Black girl of stealing, and then she decided to shoot her because she was angry and because she was a racist. But that is not true. There's like surveillance footage that, you know, actually does show Latasha Harling's stealing, and it does actually show her essentially throwing the first punch and attacking Do Sunja. So the, you know, the media narrative, as well as what was caught on video camera, is very different. And this is something I learned from my relatives. I would have never learned about this from the internet or from, you know, watching the news.
Well, and I think when I read about it, I don't think it said any, I believe what I read did say that it was, you know, a wrongful, that it didn't admit, which of course it's horrible. Somebody died over a bottle of orange juice. Right. Like, which obviously it was more than that because there was an attack. I believe that what I had read, though, was that it was a Korean store owner accused someone of having stolen, you know, wrongfully shot her because of the theft. Not that there was any violence preceding it or anything. And it's hard because it's, I guess on one hand, it's kind of morbidly fascinating that the media was as divisive back then as it is now. And I think we see the other side of things now more because of the rise of non-traditional media, whether that be podcasts or YouTube channels or, you know, people's blogs and Substacks or whatever it is. But I didn't expect this to be a facet of our conversation, but it corroborates everything that you're saying in terms of like the narrative not being representative of what you're saying. There's the proof actually points to, and it's just, that's gross. That's disgusting.
Yeah, definitely. It's like the media, like, I feel like because the media, their goal is to like, you know, sell papers or to sell advertising, like, you know, the news, they want to sell advertising. They focus more on like sensationalism and like more try to like push false narratives just to like, you know, like, I guess the terms like rage bait people rather than like just telling the truth, because I feel like they're like kind of like incentivized to rage bait people rather than tell an accurate account of what happens. Because if they just told the accurate truth, people would not really care, and it just wouldn't sell papers or sell ads. So they're like incentivized to like, you know, lie in a way.
Yeah, because you made a good point. Even obviously today it is primarily clicks that they're getting for, and they have to evoke emotion to get you to impulse click on whatever bullshit headline it is that they've written, even when sometimes those headlines are entirely misrepresentative of even what's in their article. And that's entirely aside from the fact that it may, you know, the article itself probably misrepresents the truth in some way, or at least is omitting a big part of the truth, even like what I read about this event with Latasha. And But it is, yeah, it had to have, it was always the same mechanic, even though it wasn't clicks back then. Yeah, if you see that headline and it pisses you off, you're going to snatch it up. It's just, it's weird because that, I don't know that that's even necessarily human nature. I was about to say that it is. I think that's more corporate nature but a lot of the things that you were talking about that contributed to this, at least the cultural stuff that was going on there, is interesting, because a lot of that is very human issues where it's, okay, we're seeing an influx of people, we are othering whatever this other community is, but also savvy business people coming in and maybe doing some shady business dealings in terms of kind of pushing people out. And I don't know, it's fascinating because we are so far removed from it, and it is this pivotal event in American history. But that's why it was so.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
So excited to talk to you about it, because I want to get this nitty-gritty kind of look at it all. So, you know, we have the conventional narrative kind of laid out. We have some of what you've learned, at least on one of these the key incidents that kind of led into this. Where do we go from here? I know you mentioned that was in 1991, this store owners being kind of villainized in the media. Where do we go from there?
So from there, I would say, well, this is something I want to mention that I'm sure you're familiar with the rapper Ice Cube.
Yes.
Yeah, so Ice Cube, he released a song called Black Korea. And Black Korea is like a song that's essentially, the lyrics are about like killing Korean-American shop owners and burning down their stores. And it was essentially like a response to the death of Latasha Harlins. And this song was like, it became like a major hit that was played by radio stations everywhere. And I think one of the reasons why it was such a big hit was it was because of the shock value, and, you know, the lyrics were so violent that, you know, it created a lot of controversy. And a lot of people would say that this song, Black Korea, like helped, you know, add fuel to the, you know, violence of the upcoming LA riots. And then, you know, after, you know, the song Black Korea was released, like months later, of course, we have the, you know, the Rodney King incident where, you know, four, you know, LAPD officers who were, you know, white, maybe took things a bit too far, and they, you know, beat the crap out of Rodney King. And the whole incident was caught on camera and aired. It was broadcasted to the entire country, and it created a lot of outrage, and, you know, it definitely added a lot more fuel to the fire. And then, you know, these four LAPD officers were eventually acquitted in the brutal beating of Rodney King. And that is like the spark. That's like the match being thrown into the gasoline. And that was like the incident that really created the LA riots. And people were like really mad. They saw like the LAPD as being crooked. They saw the government as being corrupt. And they saw like the entire system as being rigged against them. And there's just a lot of pent up anger from the Latasha Harlins incident, and of course, Ice Cube's Black Korea, you know, fueling, adding, you know, fuel to the fire, and, you know, the LA riots, you know, they became, like, they got out of control. So the LA riots began on April 29th, 1992. And many of us Korean Americans, we refer to that day as Sa-yi-gu. And Sa-yi-gu essentially means 4-2-9, in other words, April 29th. So, like, Sa-yi-gu is kind of like, that was the beginning of the LA riots, which lasted all the way until May 4th, 1992. And, you know, as I mentioned, lots of businesses were robbed, looted. You know, many civilians were attacked. There was also the a guy named Reginald Denny, who was a trucker, who was dragged outside of his truck and nearly beaten to death. And his entire beating was caught on camera and aired worldwide. And, you know, this also, like, added more fuel to the fire. And eventually, you know, as I mentioned, lots of Korean American owned small businesses were getting looted and burned down. And this, you know, so this led to many, and also, like, the LAPD, you know, they were overwhelmed. Like, you know, there were riots everywhere. So they decided that they wanted to, like, focus their efforts on protecting wealthier, richer neighborhoods like Beverly Hills and Fairfax. So many areas of LA were essentially banded and left to fend for themselves. And this included, you know, Koreatown, which,
yeah, your entire livelihood is now exposed. And the idea of wanting to defend that is not, I think any rationally thinking person can get behind that. Like, it's okay, we're, our civil systems are failing us. Like, what else do you do? You know, and it's, I don't know. So, and I guess in these businesses being looted, and they weren't specifically being targeted because they were Korean. This was just, you know, it's riots, people loot. This is what happens, right? Is that correct?
I would say that's kind of half correct. So, you know, obviously, you know, riots, people are just going to loot whatever stores they want to. However, I feel like, because of the whole Latasha Harlins incident, as well as Ice Cube's Black Korea, there was, like, you know, a lot of anger towards the Korean American community. And like, many people, like, just hated, I mean, like, many Blacks and Latinos really hated Korean Americans. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there were some rich, wealthy Korean immigrants who started buying properties and Black and Latino neighborhoods and jacked up the rent and were essentially kind of like slum lords. So there was just, like, a lot of animosity towards Korean American businesses. So it is a fact that Korean American businesses were disproportionately affected. Like, a lot more of them were robbed and looted and burnt down compared to other parts of LA. And that was definitely due to the racial tensions.
I didn't realize that. Yeah, I had no idea. It's hard, you know, some of the stuff when I try and research this, I have to use screen reading technology to be able to, that's how I read stuff on a computer or on a smartphone and all that. And it's a lot of stuff can be, or not can be, a lot of stuff is inaccessible. So I wasn't able to necessarily find, get a good understanding or a good grasp on exactly what the, I guess, not ratio, I guess, yeah, I guess the ratio of damage in the different rates across different ethnic groups of what were affected, what neighborhoods were affected more than others. So, and what your family members that you talked to, They were living here around this time? Like, were they in LA at this time?
Yes. So I do have many family members who were living in LA, you know, during the Los Angeles 1992 riots. And some of them actually stayed behind, while others, they kind of, like, fled. Like, as soon as the chaos began, they were like, hey, we're out of here. we don't want to, you know, stick around. And, you know, like the footage of Reginald Denny getting beaten up and being aired on the news, like, definitely inspired some of my relatives to leave town. And, you know, many of my relatives, you know, during this time, like, they kind of just stayed indoors. They refused to leave their homes because there's a good chance that they might get beaten up or killed. And it was just really, really dangerous out there. So, and so many of them just, like, you know, they just didn't want to take any chances.
Yeah, which is, it's crazy having to actively be fearful for your life. Like, the idea that that was in one of the bigger cities in America, like, 30 years ago, like, that, it's hard to put yourself in those shoes or imagine what it would be like to be in that role. Were any of them entrepreneurs? Did any of them have shops that were being looted, or they were just living there?
So yes, many of them did have stores. So my uncle, for instance, he actually owned and ran a liquor store, and someone actually spray painted graffiti on his store that said, "Go back to China," even though, you know, he's not
Korean.
Yeah, he's obviously.
Yeah.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
But obviously, many people, they can't tell the difference, you know, Korea, China, Japan, it's all the same to them. And like, you know, I mentioned earlier, like, many, you know, Korean Americans own small businesses because, you know, there were no real job opportunities for them. So you really didn't have, like, a choice but to start your own business. And that's kind of how it was back then. So the vast majority of my relatives did own stores back then.
It's just crazy. I mean, it adds, living there is one thing, I think, you know, understandably terrifying, like, for the reasons that I've already said, but yes, then having that skin in the game as well is just, I would imagine, in talking to them about all of this, is this something that is still very emotional for them that draws, I would imagine, like, that would draw up a lot of rage talking about.
Yeah. So it's definitely, you know, a sensitive subject. It's definitely something that, to some people brings up quite a bit of rage, and it's definitely something that, many, you know, Korean Americans are, you know, telling their kids about the LA riots and the rooftop Koreans, because I learned a lot of this from, you know, my parents, as well as, you know, my relatives who live in LA. And like, this is, like, you know, like, a deeply personal story for, you know, Korean Americans. And, you know, the LA riots were horrible. Like, I believe there were, like, at least 60 plus deaths, and there were, like, over 2,000 injuries, and roughly around, like, I think it was like $1 billion in property damage, and at least half of that $1 billion was in Koreatown. And, you know, like, I believe it was like at least 2,000 Korean American owned businesses were either damaged or destroyed. Like, a lot of businesses were destroyed and damaged. Like, I know, we hear about how the rooftop Koreans, you know, saved Koreatown, but, you know, they did, you know, take up arms and station themselves on rooftops of their stores to help, you know, deter writers, but the truth is, not every Korean American owned store had, you know, a rooftop Korean protecting it. And overall, there was like a lot of damage, and the rooftop Koreans were not able to like successfully fend off all riders. And they were able to successfully fend off lots of them. So had it not been for them, there would have been like a lot more damage. Like it probably would have been like over 2 billion in property damages. So
yeah, you know,
this is definitely something that's very personal. And you know, another thing I want to bring up is going back to the you know, the story of Ice Cube, as I mentioned earlier. So Ice Cube, he used to be the spokesperson for a company called St. Ides, which is a brand of malt liquor. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, many Korean American many Korean Americans owned liquor stores. And as a result of the LA riots, who they blamed on Ice Cube, they refused to stock St. Ides malt liquor on their shelves. So many, you know, Korean American-owned liquor stores were boycotting St. Ides, and the boycotts got so bad to the point that St. Ides eventually ended up firing Ice Cube as their spokesperson.
What?
Yeah.
That's it. So, and that was all, they were boycotting pre-riot or post-riot?
Yeah, like post-riot, like many, okay, like Korean Americans, including my relatives, would say that Ice Cube played like a very large role in, you know, instigating these riots. Like, you know, his song Black Korea, you know, like I mentioned, if you look at the lyrics for Black Korea, it's essentially a song about robbing Korean American owned businesses and setting them on fire. Like many people would say that that song like contributed heavily to the LA riots. And Ice Cube has also done like some interviews attacking the Korean American community as a whole. So like the Korean American community as a whole like really, really, really hates Ice Cube. But like they just like hate him. They hate him the same way Jews hate Hitler. Like that's kind of how Ice Cube is to the Korean American community. He's the Hitler.
So, that's interesting. And I'm not discrediting that here. I'm asking this for the sake of curiosity, because, you know, I get that is their sentiment. I'm curious what your thoughts on that are, just having looked into it to create this graphic novel. Because, you know, people talk about media in general influencing people's, like, you know, video games, like Grand Theft Auto or something, like influencing people to go out and do dumb or terrible things, whether that's stealing or killing people or whatever. And I have a very hard time buying into that, because I it's not that that doesn't happen on any level. There's always going to be the people who don't have a lot of critical thinking skills that can be influenced by something like that. But and it's not to say that we aren't influenced by media in any way, but being influence to the extent that you are going to act upon it and do something that is objectively a bad decision or objectively deplorable is something I have a hard time. And I feel like is another almost narrative that the media tends to push. So for you, after having looked into all of this to the level that you have, do you feel like that song actually had that big of a direct impact in playing into that?
I would say to a small extent, yes, it did play like a role. However, I feel like even without that song, like there still would have been like a lot of rioting. So I feel like that song kind of like added to the tension, but it's not like the, you know, the sole reason behind the tension. And, you know, I definitely agree with you that like, you know, media doesn't like always influence people to do things. Like, you know, I'm, you know, against the idea that video games cause school shootings. And, you know, obviously, like, I do feel like, for instance, the song Black Korea by Ice Cube was like played by radio stations everywhere. Like, it was a big hit prior to the LA riots. But then during and after the LA riots, no radio station ever touched Black Korea ever again. Like, that song was never played on the radio ever again. So so that is like something that's interesting.
It is interesting. That's very interesting. Like a very, I'd have to think on that more. Because I don't know that I've heard of that happening with something else, you know, I guess. And part of that might be because we don't see typically when there is something that is posed. Like, I agree with the things that you just said, like personally, and, you know, I'm sure some people listening won't, but I guess typically when we see that being drawn, that these, whatever these different things are, whether it be a song or video games, like we just talked about, being the instigator for things happening, there's never a direct point to, oh, it was this video game caused this incident. So we don't get to see if there's that immediate pullback like that. But it's just, it's funny to me, even with that, seeing like, okay, everyone was horrible. Like, I guess the dynamic there between, okay, everyone was okay promoting that until something, the actual riots. I don't know. I guess I just did a lot of rambling there, not actually exploring my thoughts on that very well. So I'm just going to move along here. But with, you know, getting into where we were at kind of before I pulled you into that little tangent, I guess. So I was stationed in Southern California when I was in the...
No matter what's on your plate or your mind this holiday season, the UPS Store wants to help. With our pack and ship guarantee, we're helping gifts arrive safely to guarantee more...
They know me so well. Picture perfect gifts.
We're helping guarantee more smiles with our pack and ship guarantee. If we pack it and ship it, we guarantee it. Your items arrive safe or your money back. Stop by your local The UPS Store for holiday help shipping holiday gifts. Visit theupsstore.com/guarantee for full details. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, prices, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details.
Marines, and I know LA, but like, I'm not familiar with it to the extent of like, I don't know if I ever went to Koreatown, and obviously that would have been decades after the riots. At that point in time, I'm kind of curious, obviously, that, like you said, that was a tremendous amount of damage that was done there. Do you know roughly how big it was? And then how much of a prevalence there was, like, with the rooftop Koreans themselves? Like, how, I know this wasn't like an organized group necessarily, but do you know numbers-wise generally how many of the rooftop Koreans there were versus, like, what percentage of business owners that was and things like that?
To be honest, no, because it does seem like a lot of the rooftop Koreans were kind of, like separate from one another. It wasn't like there was like one guy or like one group that was like leading all the rooftop Koreans. It's more like you had like different pockets of like Korean Americans who decided, hey, let's grab some guns and station ourselves on the rooftops of some stores. And there were like multiple like pockets of rooftop Koreans that didn't really like communicate or interact with one another very much. So to be honest, I don't know how many there were. And I also think like some numbers might not be accurate. Like I had like an uncle who claims that he was one of the rooftop Koreans, but then he also claims that he wasn't, and then he claimed that he was again. What? So yeah, so I
stolen valor.
Yeah, like I feel like a lot of like older Korean American males who are like in their like 60s or something will like falsely claim to be rooftop Koreans. So I don't really know how many rooftop Koreans there really were, like, you know, during that time. It's kind of hard to, you know.
That's funny. They like, you ran into that with multiple people? Well, they'll claim, but there's where it's either wishy-washy like that, or there's no actual factual evidence to back it up.
Yeah, I think it's like, for instance, with one of my uncles, he claimed he was not one, but then I'll say, like, in recent years, like over the past several years, like the rooftop Koreans have become like really popular on the internet and through memes, and you know, lots of people are like talk about them, like even politicians are like bringing up the rooftop Koreans, and because they become so popular, I feel like a lot of like, you know, many older Korean American will like claim that they were rooftop Koreans just because they want to like, you know, score some points and
yeah,
cool, you know. So I feel like my uncle is doing that.
That's hilarious. At the same time, it's not, because like that bothers me on one extent. Like obviously people, I mean, it's people lying. That bothers me just in general. But like, that's also kind of hilarious. Did you press your uncle on it at all, of like him being kind of wishy-washy on it?
Yeah, I did. But he keeps like changing his story and saying that I don't know what I'm talking about. So yeah,
that means he lied. Yeah, that means he wasn't never, which I'm sure you see, but that's funny. So in terms of, I know you kind of summarized some of what was going on earlier. Obviously, they're armed. There's a lot of warning shots and things like that. I'm assuming barricading their stores. But what else? I don't even know what to ask about them other than this idea of like, what did that look like? I mean, Avi, you've made this into a comic book. So like you have an autistic idea, at least, of what this stuff looked like. Like, what can you try and paint the picture maybe of what it looked like, you know, if you hit one of these pockets where these store owners have decided to resist, like, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously there are like little pockets of, you know, several rooftop Koreans, and essentially, you know, in South Korea, military service is mandatory for all males. So a lot of older Korean Americans, males during the LA riots, you know, they have previously served in the Korean military, so they were very familiar with guns and how to use them. And then you also like had another group of Korean Americans. These are like the younger Korean Americans who did not have any military training, and many probably never touched a gun in their lives. So of course these idiots would fire warning shots instead of using blanks or something. But you know, all the, you know, Korean American rooftop Koreans who previously served in the Korean military, they did not fire any warning shots. They were not as reckless. They focused mostly on like firing blanks to scare away looters. And so mostly the way it was with the rooftop Koreans is that they just stood on top of the rooftops of their stores looking for rioters. You know, and just the act of like standing on top of the rooftop of your store with a gun like scares away looters. Like, no looter is gonna like risk it. They're not gonna be like, hey, let's go rob that store. Like, it's too scary. And it's kind of like having like a beware of dog sign on your front door. Like, I have an aunt who doesn't own any pets, but she has a beware of dog sign at her house.
Yeah.
So that obviously scares away, you know, potential burglars. So
it's a show of force. And if there's, okay, if I can go there, or I can go down the street to where there's no one on the rooftop with a gun and rob that place, logic would dictate that that's what I'm going to, it makes sense. I was just, it's, yeah, I guess. And I hadn't realized, I guess I wasn't aware of the fact that like this, that didn't become necessarily like directly violent for them. Obviously there was the friendly fire incident that you mentioned, but like, yeah, they weren't just picking people off. It was, they were up there, which is, I'm sure, it obviously could have boiled over into more, but it's just, I didn't have the full understanding of how that actually took place, I guess, in terms of the extent of action that was taken. But so What was it about it that made you want to do this? Because I know this is not your background. You have more of a traditional, more like corporate background. Like, why did you write this? I know you're working on your second graphic novel now. Like, why? What led to all of this?
So yeah, I do have a more corporate background. So I spent like over a decade working in like product marketing as well as product management within enterprise B2B SaaS. And obviously working in corporate America, there's just not as many opportunities to be creative. I know, you know, product marketing does have like some opportunities to be creative, but you know, I just like really needed like a creative outlet. So one thing I wanted to do is, you know, is like write my own graphic novel. Like ever since I was a kid, I've always been like a huge fan of like comics and graphic novels. And, you know, and like one of the first comics I read was like a Korean comic called, Hopuri Yangam. And this was like my first time being like exposed to the world of comics. And I remember as a kid being like wowed by it, being like shocked, surprised. Like I never, like it was just really cool. And it was kind of like different from all those other like, you know, picture books for kids, like, you know, Clifford the Red Dog or, you know, those type of books. Like it was just, you know, different. And that was kind of like, you know, my first time experiencing comics. And since then I've been reading like comic books from Marvel, DC, you know, reading like Batman, Spider-Man. I've also been reading like comics from Image, like Spawn, as well as many like Japanese manga, like Dragon Ball and, you know, Naruto.
So
and,
you're like deep into it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I have like a very large comic book and graphic novel collection. Like, it's massive. Like, I would say my collection is worth at least like $20,000. Like, I have a very big collection.
What? So, was that something that you, I get you've kind of consumed that your whole life, but had you dabbled in any of that, or was that just like, this is something that I'm going to undertake because I, like you said, for the creative outlet.
So, you know, I've always wanted to like be a creator and, you know, rather than just simply consuming comic books, I always wanted to like create one. So, in high school, I did like a, try, you know, creating my own comic book by writing and drawing it. And this comic book that I drew in high school is like really, really, really bad. Like I cannot draw. Like it's embarrassingly bad. Like it's so bad that no one will ever see it or read it. And hopefully it stays that way. And, you know, after working on this really terrible comic in high school, I kind of like gave up on comics for a while. And then, you know, during the COVID-19 pandemic, I suddenly like had like the urge to, you know, like explore comics again. But this time, you know, I would only write the script. I wouldn't draw it. I would like hire a professional artist to draw it. And I would only like write the script. So this would be like more of a professional, you know, serious attempt at creating a graphic novel rather than like some side hobby that I did in high school. And, you know, and then a few years later in, you know, 2022, I finally like got around to like creating this graphic novel. So that's when I came up with the idea for Return of the Rooftop Koreans as like, you know, the story of the Rooftop Koreans was starting to become more and more popular, especially online, and more people were talking about it. And I also noticed that there was not a comic book or a graphic novel about the Rooftop Koreans. So I decided that I wanted to be like the first person to create a comic or graphic novel based on the Rooftop Koreans. And, you know, when writing the script, I, you know, did a lot of research, you know, into the rooftop Koreans and the LA riots. I also spoke with lots of relatives, and, you know, I found that it was really like hard to tell like a historically accurate story that, you know, like I just like had a hard time like trying to write like a historically accurate story. So what I decided to do instead is like kind of like tell more of a fictional story that's like a homage to the rooftop Koreans. So it's called Return of the Rooftop Koreans, which is like a fictional story about the next generation of rooftop Koreans who...
Okay.
Yeah, so it's about like a fictional new generation of rooftop Koreans. And it's like, that's like inspired by like the rooftop Koreans from 1992. So it's not like a historically accurate retelling, but like a fictional story that's takes place in the present day. So that's kind of like the story that I wanted to tell instead.
Which is, I mean, kind of fits in. We've just had riots over the past couple of years, you know, with like the George Floyd riots and stuff like that, which is, huh. So is it, did you have it take place during, in another city during riots, same kind of, or, and it's store owners, or how did you set this up?
So it takes place in a, I would say like a post COVID era Los Angeles. So it does take place in the present day. And I would say like it'll take place somewhere around 2022 when I first wrote the script. And it's essentially like the story about a small Korean American business owner named Ernest Kwon. And Ernest Kwon, you know, he has a wife, he has a daughter, you know, he's a hardworking, typical Korean-American man, and he is a second-generation Korean-American as he was born in this country. And obviously in the post-COVID-19 world, he finds that his small business, which is a small grocery store called Kwonmart, is struggling financially. You know, he doesn't have a lot of money. Obviously, the economy is bad. There's, you know, problems with inflation and, you know, yeah, he's, you know, struggling like many Americans are today. And one day, two thugs show up at his store. And one of these thugs is a Korean-American thug named Jason Lee. And the other is a black thug named Solomon Reed. And these two thugs, they basically demand that Ernest Kwon pay them protection money. And if he pays them protection money, they'll make sure that nothing bad happens to his store. And Ernest tells them that, unfortunately, he doesn't have any money, so he's unable to pay them. So these two thugs, they tell him, you know, there are other ways to pay. And then that's when they try to kidnap his daughter. And, you know, he is, yeah, found in a situation where he has no choice but to kill both of these men in self-defense. And as a result of that, you know, the media, they lie about the facts and distort everything, kind of like they did with the Latasha Harlins incident. So they falsely portray Ernest Kwon as being like some sort of racist who's like evil. And they, this like rhetoric that's being spread by the media ends up resulting in riots appearing across LA. So there's like almost like a LA riots 2.0 happening.
And yeah,
because of that, Ernest Kwon is now in a situation where he has to take a stand and lead a new generation of rooftop Koreans into defending Koreatown. So that's kind of like a brief overview or synopsis of like the story.
That's cool. How, I mean, in terms of the script, again, I'm entirely unfamiliar with these kinds of things. How many, do you know the word count on the script?
I have no idea. I don't No, but for the page count is 148 total pages. However, there's 117 story pages as well as like bonus content, which is like character bios and like an art gallery. But it's 117 total pages.
How did that work? And like for you to find an illustrator, is that, I guess on one hand, I feel like it's got to be tough because you've read the story, you probably have a certain style and your own pictures of it in mind. And now you're trying to get their own skills to match that creation. I guess, was that a challenge to get what you had in your mind to match obviously someone else's own styling? Or was it just, okay, I found someone I know I can work with, let's bring this thing to print?
You know, when I first wrote the script, the one thing I did is I took a lot of time to like research the comic book creation process, like what are all the steps, what's involved, like what do I do after I write a script. So after I wrote the script, I hired like a professional editor who has previously edited comic books to edit my script, and he also like provided like guidance on like, you know, how to find artists and how to vet them. And I found like an artist named Av Lepper. He's a Chilean, he lives in Chile. And he has like this really unique art style where he kind of like blends American comic book art with like Japanese and Asian comic book art. Like he's able to kind of like blend the East with the West, which kind of, you know, in a way works well with the story of the return of the rooftop Koreans, as that's also kind of like, you know, the East meets the West. And, you know, I worked with him to, like create like concept art of like what the characters will look like, as well as storyboards. And, you know, he did a really good job, like really bringing these characters to life and bringing the story to life. And the thing about comic books and graphic novels is it's a very collaborative process. Like, it's not like writing a novel where you only have like one author, like one person, you know, kind of, you know, like it's just one person's vision. With, you know, a comic book or graphic novel, it's, you know, a collaborative process. So it's like multiple people's different visions, you know, coming together. And, you know, I feel that when it comes to creating comic books, it's definitely, beneficial to be like open-minded rather than like having a very specific idea of, like, it has to look like this, it has to look this way. It's, I think it's good to be like open-minded. Like, he interpreted different like scenes in my script, you know, different from how I would have interpreted, and I actually thought like some of his interpretations were like better and were like an improvement over some of the stuff I wrote in the script. And you know, and I like that. And I also like worked with a colorist from Indonesia. So a colorist is like the person that adds like the colors to the line art. So, you know, Av Lepper from Chile, he did the line art. And then I had another guy, Donnie from Indonesia, color everything in. So that's kind of like how we were able to like bring this story to life.
It's cool. It's just, again, totally foreign to me. It's interesting too, outside of the story. I was an artist when I could see, and I used to nerd out over seeing all the different tools, especially I began getting very interested in a lot of like the ability to create digital art inside of like Adobe Illustrator and stuff like that as I guess closer to when I lost my sight. So it's like it picturing in my mind what all that process would look like to me. It's just, it's cool, man. It is any sort of collaboration like that seems like it would just, yes, the outcome can be incredible, but also add a lot of complexity to the process. And it's fascinating. I know you, where does this stand right now? I know this one should be out by the end of the year, correct? Is that what you're thinking?
Yes. So the book is 100% done and 100% completed. And I believe back in September, I started a pre-order campaign on both Kickstarter and Indiegogo to get, you know, pre-orders for the book. So I know when most people think of Kickstarter or Indiegogo, they associate that with like crowdfunding. But this, you know, graphic novel was entirely funded by myself. And I'm kind of just using Kickstarter and Indiegogo for more like taking pre-orders rather than like trying to crowdfund a project. Yeah. So the book is with the printer right now. So the printer is like working on it. I did send them the print files a couple weeks ago. And I have not received like a proof from them yet, but I will get like a proof soon. And once the proof has been approved, they'll then start mass printing the graphic novels. And it's believed that, you know, they should be arriving in December, but I can't like guarantee that. Like there could be, you know, like delays or hiccups, but hopefully the graphic novels are ready in December and then I can, you know, get those shipped out to people who pre-order the book.
Are you dying to have the proof in your hands? Like, I feel like having that tangible has to be like, that's going to be so cool.
Yeah, I definitely really want to have the, you know, the proof in my hands. I definitely want to make sure that like everything looks right and like nothing was like screwed up during the preprint process and, you know, make sure like all the colors look right and everything just isn't like, you know, faded. And, you know, I'm definitely dying to have that proof copy and hopefully we get it right the first time and there doesn't need to be like a second proof. And and hopefully the graphic novel is all printed and ready to go in December.
Cool, man. Where can people find it?
So the best way to find the book is to simply Google Return of the Rooftop Greens, or you can just go on Kickstarter or Indiegogo and search for Return of the Rooftop Greens. And you can then like back the book there. So we did have like a Kickstarter Indiegogo campaigns for the book, which the campaigns are over, but the campaigns do accept late contributions as well as late pledges. So you are still able to pre-order the book via Kickstarter and Indiegogo.
Cool. How many, like, do you know how roughly how many people pre-ordered and all that?
Yeah, I would say roughly so far, it's roughly around 100. I did also take some pre-orders directly through Zelle. So yeah, so it's roughly around 100, but I'm also planning on putting the book on my personal website in December. So if these are, I know some people, they don't really like pre-ordering. They're not a big fan of that. They want to like order something and get it a few days later. So yeah, for people like that, you know, they can just wait until December where I'll have the book Return of the Rooftop Koreans on my website to order.
Sweet. And I'll have links to that stuff in the show notes. What else have we not touched on here that you'd like to plug or you know, I can go for another 10, maybe 15 minutes here that I need to be wrapping up, but what else?
I guess there's two things I also wanted to like maybe talk about. So the first would be like more about like the legacy of the rooftop Koreans and what they mean today. And then the second would be like more on like the book I'm working on right now, which I mentioned earlier is my second graphic novel.
Okay. Tell me about it.
So, you know, first, going back to, you know, the rooftop Koreans, you know, obviously in recent years, they become very popular. You know, there's lots of memes about the rooftop Koreans and there's, you know, lots of YouTube videos about them and articles, and many politicians are mentioning the rooftop Koreans. And every single time there's like a riot, someone always like says something like, maybe it's time for the rooftop Koreans to make a comeback. You know, maybe it's time for them to return. And it's like, you know, people saying these things and sharing these memes that kind of like inspired my graphic novel. Like, I was like, what if the rooftop Koreans really did come back? What would that be like? So that's kind of like what my graphic novel is about. And obviously, the subject of the rooftop Koreans has been, you know, very touchy and very sensitive. And, you know, there are many people that view the rooftop Koreans as like heroes, you know, that stood up for the Second Amendment. And you know, they like embody what self-defense is all about. And, you know, some people will say like, why do we need the Second Amendment? Well, the rooftop Koreans is like the example that, many people would like bring up. And obviously there are like other people who, you know, are under the false assumption that the rooftop Koreans were racist. And, you know, I actually did get like a few messages on like Facebook and Instagram accusing me of racism. And they're like, you know, really angry, almost like death threats. And yeah, so, and ironically, you know, all these messages like come from like white liberals who are like getting offended on behalf of Black people, saying that I am a racist against Black people, which is odd. I never had like a Black person tell me that my book was racist, which is, you know, interesting. And I even had like some Black people like send me messages saying that they were actually fans of the rooftop Koreans. So I also thought that was interesting as well. And you know, obviously after like, you know, the LA riots, another thing that I want to point out is that prior to like the LA riots, the Korean American community was like very siloed. They mostly kept to themselves. They didn't really interact with a lot outside of their own community. But I think like, you know, because of the LA riots, that kind of like forced the Korean American community to kind of like, you know, branch out, interact more with like other races and, you know, be more involved in civic life and, you know, like to be more like visible and more out there. And, you know, that's definitely like something that I noticed like after the LA riots, like, this is something I learned from my relatives. Like, it's like the way Korean Americans kind of like view their role in society has like changed. It's become like they wanted to like be seen less as like outsiders and be like more involved in like American society. So that's another thing that I wanted to bring up.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about this country is it is a melting pot. Right? And I think most people can, I would hope most people can appreciate that, realize like everyone who is here is the descendant of immigrants other than people who are descendants of Native Americans. Like that is what has built this country, and that integration is why this country is so unique. And it is, no, it's another interesting thing with all of the, I think the things that were probably at play leading into the riots in terms of the other tensions were that with these different communities integrating, especially if there was such a big influx of Koreans to America in the 80s, like our culture is so vastly different. You know, like I've been to Japan. I spent time in Japan. Like Asian cultures are so much different than American culture. I'm sure that difference there, on top of language barriers and everything else, because they are so vastly different, that it probably contributed into that stuff. But it is, I don't know. I think the vast majority of people share that same sentiment of like, yes, we just want everyone to be able to be integrated, to get those different, the tastes of all of those different cultures to kind of show in our own. And it's just, I don't know. It's hopefully, I guess your family would agree that we are in more of a place that's along those lines now than they were back then.
Yeah. And another thing I learned from, you know, talking to my relatives is that back in, you know, 1992, LA was very like self-segregated, like, you know, blacks lived here, Koreans lived here, whites lived here, Hispanics lived here, and there just wasn't as much, you know, interaction between the different ethnic groups. But
it's almost like you see in prisons. Like, yeah. Which is weird. That's wild.
Yeah, but nowadays, LA has become a lot more integrated. Like, there's still, like, areas that are, you know, like, heavily, like, favored towards one ethnic group, but it is a lot more integrated now than it was back in 1992.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's the hope, is there's always being progress made, right? So you would hope that that's the case now, and it's just, I think that's, it's cool, man, and it's cool that you're getting to share, that you do have a personal tie to all of this, and I think that's, it's really neat, and hopefully your family getting their hands on this, too, is like a, I guess, almost feels like things are kind of coming full circle, because it's cool how you've been able to bring it into, it's not like a critique, but almost like commenting on where we are today, you know, 30 years later, we are, like the narrative of your graphic novel is very, it is fitting. It's still accurate now. And it fits everything that you said. It fits perfectly into how, where things are at today. And I think it's neat, man. So as we're wrapping up here, cause I do need to hop off of here, tell us a little bit about this other book that you're working on and where people can find it. And then we'll be finished here.
So I actually have two books that I'm working on right now. So the first is my second graphic novel, which is a fantasy story that's inspired by video games like Ico, Shadow of the Colossus, and The Last Guardian. So it was like originally an idea that I had for a video game, but I decided to, you know, turn that into a graphic novel. And this is like completely different from Return of the Groove Top Koreans. And hopefully it will be out sometime in either late 2026 or early 2027. And the second book that I'm working on is a prose novel. So this is like a crime thriller that's strongly inspired by like, so it's part of the, you know, catch a serial killer genre. So it's like strong inspired by like Silence of the Lambs or Seven. So it's basically about like a cop trying to catch a serial killer. And hopefully that'll be out sometime next year.
Awesome, man. And I'll have links to your website in the show notes so people can keep up with you on all that stuff. This is all very exciting, and I'm excited to hear how it all turns out for you, man. I mean, obviously we'll stay in touch here, but thank you again for coming on. And just, I think, again, this was a unique episode, and I've got someone else I want to connect you with who's been on the show before, who's more in the graphic novel space, that I think would be good for you guys to talk. So yeah, thank you for taking the time.
Cool. I'd love to meet him or her. And, you know, thanks again for having me on, Zach. It's been great talking about the LA riots and the rooftop Koreans. And I really enjoyed this conversation. And you know, Zach, thanks again for inviting me as a guest. Take care.
For sure. And thanks everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Remember, if you haven't already and you've been listening for a while, leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening. That helps grow the show tremendously and all of the different podcasting apps algorithms. And remember to share this thing around with another curious mind who needs to hear it. I'll see you next time.